A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I was in the shower, I was cleaning my ass and making all shirts all sparkly, spanky clean.
I'm not the funny one, I'm the pretty one.
Cock shots. I just checked myself out.
Beatles, music, wine, and then loop up and get on top.
A glory hole is like a dick theater of a magic around.
Which means your pants had better come off. Mama needs playtime.
We're not sluts.
We just love. Hello, this is Angela.
And this is Brad.
Welcome back to another week here at By the By.
Ah!
We have some familiar guests at this point.
But still very special.
Yes.
We like that.
Yes.
So we're back here with Dr. Deb and Christy. See, I got the doctor this time.
I know.
And associate am professor. Doctor. I am. Well, it's doctor
yes,
as well.
Although doctor as
my
well,
children so. Do say, yes. You're not a real doctor. You don't help anyone.
Well, you're on a podcast to fix that now.
That's right. Exactly. That's things I offer.
Just shut up, you. Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, we can jump right into it because you brought it up.
Yeah.
What we want to talk about with you guys today is parenting. I know. And Angela and I, who can barely parent ourselves, but still act like we're in our teens, we aren't a, I don't think we're a good resource for parenting.
No.
But we want to be a better resource. So we want advice on raising children in today's society in I'm going to say, I don't want to say non-normal, but different than the social norm, maybe.
Sure.
Sex positive.
Yeah.
There's the word.
It's
yeah.
pretty key idea, yeah. I yeah. think. Yeah. Yeah. This is a topic close to my heart, but I would say probably as a personal passion rather than something that I have kind of expertise professionally in. But I've done a lot of reading. I know a lot of people who work in this area as well around early childhood, adolescence, and other stages of life in relation to sexuality and relationships education, and know how absolutely important it is, including to the broader field of sexual and reproductive health. But it's a thorny area. It makes people uncomfortable to be thinking about how do we talk to kids about in a non-shaming, positive way about diverse sexualities and relationship approaches.
So I think it is a thorny area, and I have, and well, I'm a parent myself, so yes. that's one thing. But again, you know, in my role as a doctor, I see many young people who haven't had that sex positive upbringing. And, you know, that can leave them very vulnerable sometimes. And they don't have the words to even sometimes just describe what we may think is a simple thing, like a vulva, for instance. Or, you know, they haven't actually learnt those words, but they also feel a great shame in even being able to raise these topics. And we know just in terms of you know, consent to sex, being have healthy relationships, that sex positivity, having that sort of being able to sort of discuss these things in that family environment in a safe way is so important. So I think there's many reasons to discuss this.
And it's something that, you know, we've run across both in actual research papers that we've read and then also personal life experiences that when you're unable to talk about something, you feel like you're the only one experiencing it. So you're no longer normal. So there's something wrong with you if you're feeling something different than the air quotes normal that you see in media. And that can be very dangerous for your mental space, which is what we want to try to help for children. We want them to feel like there's ways that they can communicate with their parents and parents with their children. And I know you're not, this isn't your area of expertise. However, you have practical experience, both of y'all have practical experience. And I think that sometimes we rely too heavily on data. And data is something that you can wrap yourself up with like a comfortable blanket, and suddenly it's a shield and it's protecting you because I have the data. But in actuality, I'm more apt to trust somebody. I mean,
how do you apply that
data? How do you apply that data? Exactly. And that's the important thing. Look, I can tell you many times what a Mozart opera sounds like, but until you hear it yourself and do it and or perform it yourself, you don't really appreciate it. So that's why we want you to sort of expand and expound.
So there's just two things I'll say which are kind of side issues, but they're key to this as well. And the first is that parenting as a concept is very new. Until about the 80s, it wasn't actually a word. Before that, you were just a parent.
Oh, as a verb. You're saying as a verb. The gerund phrase, parenting.
Now, it is a practice. And it is a practice that comes with all kinds of intensive attention and ideas and anxieties and imperatives.
And everybody has an opinion on it.
Everyone has an opinion on it. So I just wanted to start from the place of, again, compassion for how complex the process and the practice of parenting is and how much pressure people feel to get it right. Mm-hmm. And I think this is an area that, because it is complex and because it brings up fears that people will get it wrong.
Yeah.
And also it's incredibly socially contentious, as we see in the media almost every day. Yeah. And when you compare countries like the US and Australia, so we can see why people are anxious. So I guess I wanted to start from the point of saying, while a phrase like sex positive parenting resonates for me, I also don't want to assume that that's a better way of parenting. I think some of the principles are really important that we talk about, but I think people are almost always trying their absolute best to parent and to come up with an ethical framework for doing that in a way that fits with their value system. So, you know, that's my starting place. And so I always try to be really careful not to see that the things I believe in are seen as better than the ways that the things that other people believe, because there's all kinds of reasons that we may differ.
Yep. I think that's a really great place to start. I agree with you, because I do also agree that it's one area, it's also pregnancy as well, you know, you're out in the street, you're at a cafe, you've got children around, you're parenting, but actually people feel that they have a right to actually, you know, criticise or suggest or, you know, somehow get involved in the way that you're going about being a parent. So
absolutely, you can't miss it if people think that you're doing a bad job or that you should change. You hear about it within some families more than others, but also in public.
Yep.
It blew my mind the first time I had a person tell me that my child was underdressed or, you know, like, it's quite confronting.
Yeah.
But pregnancy is another place where that starts with, you know, people just deciding they can touch you.
Which is really bizarre.
That is such a bizarre cup of coffee.
No.
Because there's no other time in life that somebody can walk up to you, just randomly touch you, and it's acceptable.
Yes.
Very strange. Just on the pregnancy thing, and I will say I'm guilty of it as well, because I remember traveling with a colleague in Switzerland, and we met some friends that we had over there, and she was pregnant, very far along, maybe eight, I mean, like, right on the verge of giving birth. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been shocked if she'd gone into labor at dinner, but she had a glass of champagne, and I must have physically bristled when she ordered it, because my colleague puts his hand on my shoulder, leaned over and goes, "Relax. It's fine."
Yeah.
And, you know, and he had multiple kids, and we talked about it later. And I was like, growing up, we were always, women should never drink. That causes birth defects. And it's just like the ignorance. It's not having the information that was required.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, in these particular areas, it leads to incredible judgment.
Yeah.
And, you know, my aim with any of these kinds of topic areas is that, you know, how do we create space so that we can talk to each other about what we believe, what has influenced that, and how we can kind of all find a way to move forward. Having said that, I do feel very strongly about the importance of good quality sexuality and relationships education for all people, beginning from the very earliest age. So, you know, there is, I feel strongly about that. but I'm keener to have conversations with people who disagree than to not.
So it's been interesting, of course, in the States with the abstinence only.
Oh, yes. God. The stories I can tell you.
And now it's been rebranded. I'm just trying to remember what it's been rebranded. Oh, I know. It's been rebranded as, I think it's STI prevention or something that sounds sort of vaguely healthy.
Yes.
But it's still the same thing. And of course, we do know, and then we're not talking about the data and the evidence, but we do know that all the evidence that does come out means that the people exposed to that abstinence only, they do have earlier pregnancies, they do have higher rates of sexually transmitted infections. They are, you know, they're not in healthy relationships. And so this is not
a
good thing.
The reverse is also true. We know that in a country like the Netherlands, which has really some of the most incredibly inclusive, open, frank sexuality education right throughout life, the lowest rates of teen pregnancy, the lowest STI rates, and much better processes for identifying, naming, and connecting people to services who've experienced intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. So they're just, you know, they're sometimes the data helps.
Absolutely. But anecdotally, again, so when I was in high school, I was part of PSI, Postponing Sexual Involvement.
Wow. I know. Did you wear a ring?
We didn't do the promise rings or abstinent rings or whatever the hell that was. But we did, like, our job as high schoolers, and admittedly, the reason I wanted to do it was a performance art, and also we were getting out of school because we would go to middle schools. As high schoolers, we'd go to middle schools, and there was 6 to 8 of us, and we would go through a postponing sexual involvement for the middle schoolers, telling them the dangers of sex and all the bad things that can happen to you and all this horrible stuff now that I look back on with absolute shame that I was spouting this bullshit. But, you know, the problem with that was we were part of the PSI and we would have these away camps, and this postponing sexual involvement.
What did you get up to? Yeah. Get up to at
I think
camps.
I was the only one that left PSI a virgin. Because
It worked for somebody.
It worked for me because it terrified me. And honestly, it's still something that I find that terrifies me is, you know, growing up in a world in which sex was shameful, masturbation is shameful, only bad things come from sex, you know.
You're never taught about the pleasure.
You're not taught that sex is also fun, and if done safely, safe.
And it can really enhance connections. Yes. You're not taught that.
And there's changes happening. I mean, here, which is great because it has been very much about the nuts and the bolts. The sexuality training, or sex ed, I suppose you would call it, in schools, very patchy with teachers who haven't been sort of properly trained, really, and often just out of their comfort zone. And that's, you know, it's doing them no service at all. But there is that move to sort of ensure that now we can actually include sexual pleasure in that discussion. And that's where Holland, as you say, I mean, Holland is the Netherlands, the poster child,
that's
really.
Right.
I have said with a Dutch husband, and it's all
enough. That's true. A little biased, but no, it's true. The research is there. But pleasure is a really interesting other key concept here that really divides paradigms that we've seen in the history of sexual communication, sexual education approaches. Yeah. And it's a very tricky one. There's few places where we lead with talking, where pleasure is able to be part of the conversation when we talk about sexuality to young people. But there is incredible work happening. And also that's based in the research, which shows that if you don't talk about pleasure, you don't engage young people because they you know, that because pleasure is a part of that world and they know it.
Don't get me wrong, if you don't talk about pleasure, I check out.
But again, it comes back to the deliverers of that education.
It does,
being
their
completely out of their comfort zone. And I must say, you know, I've just watched a couple of these little videos for different ages, and which include pleasure, and you know, they're so wonderfully done, I have to say. So there are all sorts of ways that you can,
are you talking about the amazing true story of how babies are made? That a friend of mine actually animated, and it's now available on iTunes as a 3-video series. But it's animated a book which was written by and illustrated by Fiona Katauskas. I think that's how you say it, Katauskas. So she's the local, she's Australian, and it's very well recognized, this book, as being one of the a very good example of sex positive sexuality education for early childhood.
Okay. So it's how about early?
I mean, you can start as early as they can talk. Yeah.
Wow.
So because I do think there. So the other resource that I'll definitely emphasise is called Talk Soon, Talk Often.
Yes.
It was developed in Western Australia, but it's available online as quite a thick PDF, and there's also some shorter versions as well. But some of the principles behind that are, I mean, they're very robust and they're very well recognized. And really, that's the whole concept is talk soon, as early as you can, and talk often, because that then makes the culture of the family, the culture of the parenting relationship, it normalizes that sex and relationships are a part of what you talk about, is what you are able to talk about, and feel confident to talk about, and talking often also means continuing that through adolescence.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to jump to conclusions because that's what Americans do. No, but it's interesting because I completely agree with you, but I can already hear what like people where I grew up would hear, which is, oh my gosh, so you're saying as soon as a child can talk, you're talking about sex. And you know, walk us through a bit of what that might look like.
It's so
for a toddler.
It's really important to be age appropriate. Yeah. So we're not leading with teenager conversations with a toddler, but we are starting with talking about bodies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And particularly body parts, because what we know is that most parents will use a different word to describe genitals or other parts of our bodies that are sexualized than they will about arms and legs and heads.
They'll use nicknames.
And kids don't know their nicknames. Mm. They think they're the actual names.
Yes.
And
it's
so
a very good point.
That is really a problem. Not only does that mean that some kids can end up adults before they understand that it was only their family that used that particular word, but we know that if you don't, as a child, understand how to describe your body parts correctly, that has a direct impact on literacy in terms of your health generally, but also your risk in terms of being able to identify when you are experiencing unwanted abuse, forms of abuse, or unwanted touching and so on, and being able to communicate that to others. Mm. So it's about a fundamental principle of body safety, bodily integrity that kids deserve to know, so that they can understand what their body parts are and critically which parts of their body are public and which parts are private, and you know how we make sure that they're safe.
Mm-hmm. So I think you've raised a really important question, because in fact often what we're wanting to do as parents is ensure that we're responding appropriate to questions as well. Yeah. So, you know, very young children, they start to ask questions. It often is around bodies. It often is, you know, we know that it can be around, you know, touch, for instance. Maybe, you know, maybe they're touching themselves, and it's just around ensuring that you can respond to questions from those very young, you know, young age children appropriately, and that you've got resources around you as well. I think, you know, I know with my girls when they were growing up, I just made sure that I had the really good books that were recommended to me. Yep. There's books, they're more than I suppose there were CDs and various things, but age appropriate books as well were just so helpful in terms of naming those body parts. And so certainly for my daughters, I mean, they grew up absolutely understanding, you know, what a vulva was, what a vagina was, and they didn't have that sort of shame around those, or just that misunderstanding, because in fact your pet word may be very different to the family down there, and so confusion as well as being able to engage with the health system later on, as you say.
And we can assume that girls need that more, but actually boys, all kids need this. They need to be able to understand that terminology, and they need to be able to know that they can ask questions about their bodies, other bodies, and also how that relates to gender, ideas about gender, ideas about being a boy, about being a girl, ideas about touch, absolutely, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate.
Well, there's an article I read recently talking about nicknames that we have for genitalia. And the main crux of this article was that think about the number of nicknames that you have for the penis and think about the number of nicknames you have for the vagina.
Mm.
And it's, for every one the vagina has, there's 10, 15 for the penis.
Mm.
And it was this sort of, again, their point was that we sort of erase feminine sexuality. Mm. But I see it as a problem of, you know, for little boys, that just adds more confusion.
Yeah.
Mm.
If we're not using the same vernacular in the schoolyard,
mm-hmm.
like, why is that, you know, why do I call it a peepee and you call it a Johnson? I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
But why is that? Yeah. And how is that okay?
Yeah.
So it's and a confusion for little boys as well.
Yeah. If kids know when we're not talking about something directly. And so, you know, the kind of key way that they'll interpret that is that there's something to be ashamed of.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say, yes. It leads to that shame.
Absolutely.
And going beyond that, actually, then to stigma about things and just not being able to, knowing that this is a shameful conversation. And that's where, as parents, being able to just respond in a way not to sort of immediately take fright when, you know, and sort of run for the hills. But to actually be able to respond and feel confident. So I think we do have to actually, you know, there's also education for parents,
absolutely.
Which is so vital here. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this is what we're doing in this discussion, but it is ensuring that parents do feel confident themselves. And it may be that they actually are a bit out of their comfort zone with some teenage discussions, for instance. You know, and they do need to sort of, you know, find out, but that's okay. I mean, it's just about feeling confident about having that open discussion is really important.
Mm, absolutely. Mm. And, you know, there's some big and complicated concepts. Masturbation is not something that's easy for a lot of people to talk about. Consent is another one.
Yeah.
These are porn is something that we're having a very big cultural conversation about, appropriately so. And, you know, how are we making sure that the young people who are coming up through our families are getting access to information and ways of talking about these things that are going to be protective for them, rather than just saying this is too complex, you don't get access to it? Because that's not going to work as a starting point. Assuming that not giving information when it's appropriate, when kids actually are ready for it and are asking for that information, assuming that if we kind of deflect, that they will be protected, that they'll be safer, is actually completely misguided.
Mm.
And what it's doing is protecting us as adults from some very uncomfortable feelings and fears in wanting to keep our kids safe.
But then they're going to go find the information somewhere else.
They are.
Of course.
And they may also find misinformation along the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the age of the internet, I know, again, you know, it's been around a long time now, but there is this sort of anxiety around and sort of moral panic almost that inevitably any sort of screen time is going to lead you, you know, down somewhere that's inappropriate. But of course, and it's important to be able to engage with young people, to know what they are looking at on the internet, but not to be tracking them. You've also got to be able to
trust.
Have that trust, and for young people to know that they're trusted as well, but they can come to you if they feel that they're in trouble. So I think that's the key.
It's very interesting you bring that up, because, you know, we've got friends who have children who are getting to the point of driving, and it's always like, oh, well, you know, I'll put a tracker in their car so I know where they go, because I know what I did when I was a kid. I'm like, well, so that inherently, that statement right there inherently says that you're now broken. There's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And sure, you may have gotten, you know, lucky, or, you know, you made decisions that you weren't proud of, but at the same time, the children are going to do that.
Yeah.
Like, that's not something you can protect children from.
Yes.
Like, I, not having kids, I always feel like we don't have sort of a platform to speak on with children. But I feel like I have a platform for common sense, which is we all make foolish decisions.
Yeah.
And we have the ramifications of those decisions. But the better educated we are about those decisions that we might make, maybe we'll still make foolish decisions,
that's
but
right.
maybe we'll be a little safer.
Yeah, but it is that learning from those mistakes. Obviously, we want to protect people from big mistakes.
Right.
It's getting that balance right. But you've got to be able to allow people to make young people to make choices, and maybe they don't always go the right way. So it's, but it's about empowering them. So from that very young age, empowering them with language, with knowledge about what's safe, what's not safe, that's going to stand them in very good stead.
And their right way may look completely different than what you might think the right way is. That's the other thing. Because like when we say they go the right way, every person has a different right way.
Yep. And our world is different now, and actually our children will be teaching us about what they need in some ways, particularly in terms of the digital environments that they are part of, which weren't necessarily a part of the worlds of parents, certainly not grandparents. You know, I'm on the cusp for sure.
We're all on the cusp. I remember life before GPS and computers.
But, you know, I think one thing I just want to stress is this idea that, and I think this applies to good parenting, of that, you know, recognizing that parents have so much on their shoulders, but trying to keep the lines of communication open is, it's difficult, but it's also such an important part of a priority for a relationship between parent and child, because we just can't know what they're going to need to know when. What we need to be sure of is that they feel they can ask you and come to you when they need you. And you know, the more experiences that they have of you shutting down those opportunities, the less that is likely to happen.
So how do you, this is one of those questions that you could probably talk on for a week. How do you do that? How do you create a space for your children to come to you with these maybe difficult for even you to answer questions, because you don't have the answers? They have questions about gender identity, or they have questions about sexuality, either their own sexuality or somebody else's sexuality. You know, and this expands on to like poly families.
And how do you not just how do you create that, but how do you then maintain that over the years and through different life stages as they get older?
So, and go. What we want is something very succinct and bumper proof.
Look, again, I think everyone has a different philosophy and kind of ways of relating to their children. But for me, my oldest child is 12, so I've had 12 years of experience, which is not very much. But what has never stopped being a kind of key characteristic of the way that I relate to them is my curiosity and my willingness to not know what to do or to answer. So if I don't feel like I need to always be right and have a pre-existing position, that kind of helps me, because I know that we'll be able to work out the answer together. So I am intrinsically interested in what they know, where they're coming from, and to understand that, which I think is also critical, because I think we can assume things about kids all the time, either that they don't know anything or that they know more than they do, and both of those things are a problem, right? So what makes me happy is the idea that this is an ongoing conversation. So, you know, that we don't just address it once. And I know that, because I tell you, there are so many conversations I've had and I'm like, we've talked about this before, and they are still clueless. Like, they don't remember any of those previous conversations.
Angela does that with me too.
So I've got three girls. They're older now, and look, it's interesting as you're talking, because they've got very different communication styles, and I've had very different communication patterns with them. But at the core of it, there's been, you know, just the way we live in our family, which has changed over the years, and it's been around that, just allowing people to speak and responding to that, and actually not forcing conversations. I think that's something that I, with one of my daughters particularly, actually, she did not want me to sort of be proactively asking her about this, whereas another of my daughters is very keen on that, so she's very wants me to sort of ask stuff. So it's about understanding your child and what communication style suits them, but it's having at the core of it is just that ongoing discussion, which is open, which is non-judgmental, which is you're there to listen, and you know, if you don't know the answer to something, you'll find it out, and that you can encourage them to really talk about anything that they want to talk and about, and sometimes they may want to keep some secrets, of course, and that's really important as well. So, and I know growing up with, you know, Dr. Depp, their friends would, you know, when they were teenagers, their friends would often sort of get in touch
ask
with
questions.
Me, ask questions. Yeah. And so that was actually, in fact, it was actually very nice because they knew that they felt comfortable coming around and asking me questions. And that, you know, helped support my daughters then, really, in being able to ask their own questions.
I think, I mean, my kids have kind of worked out that I'm not necessarily like all other parents. So they, you know, that they also know that I... they can tell that I love it when they ask me these kinds of questions, you know, about sex, relationships, gender, bodies, whatever that might be. And they know that's partly because that's the area that I work in. So that I have to also be careful that I'm not getting overly excited when they ask me those questions because that's their story as well. Yeah, like, this is not, I don't want to, you know... They're not case studies. Yes. They're my kids, and they, you know, they get to develop and grow and be interested at their own pace.
Yes,
and I think that's really key.
Yes, it's interesting. So I tell an interesting story just as an illustration, really. But I do remember a mother coming along with her teenage daughter to our clinic. And the mum sat down and said, "No, I want you to give contraception advice to my daughter because she's going to have sex for the first time tomorrow at 7 o'clock.
Oh, God!
And I had to do I always do, which is to say, it's great that you're so supportive of your daughter, but actually I'm going to do what I do with all mums who come along. I'm going to say, look, I'm sure you don't mind, but I'm just going to get you to go and wait outside because really, you know, it's just great if I can have a conversation with your daughter. And she was fine with that, actually, which was great. Because I think, again, and it's a little bit of a different conversation, but for parents... letting go of adolescence is actually quite a challenge because they've often been so involved all those years and been their primary source of everything, really, in terms of, you know, information, etc. To then let them go so they can become autonomous adolescents, seek health services that they need themselves, I think it can be quite challenging for parents. So I think that's also a job that parents... need to think about that.
I think so. Yeah. And, you know, again, there's the philosophy of parenting. Certainly I see myself as my primary responsibility is to make my children not need me at a certain point. And so this is an area in which that you know, that applies, but that applies across every area. And that's hard. Mm. It's hard to think of putting yourself out of a job from these little people that you love so much.
But everybody needs to retire.
That's true, yes. But I think there's kind of, I guess I haven't thought about this before, but I'm sort of see three eras of parenting in this regard. So the first one is really the early childhood, and I really have relied on good resources.
Yes.
So I, you know, picture books are just the best way to do almost anything with kids when you're talking about complicated ideas, because you can really rely upon how carefully they've been constructed. If they're the right resources, I've been very proactive in looking for the ones that fit my particular set of political beliefs, you know, around sexual and gender diversity and inclusion and thinking carefully about bodily safety and those kinds of things, the ethics of relationships, consent and so on. And they get built in subtle ways from the youngest age in terms of picture books. So I've relied on resources very much. And, you know, they have set the foundation for some of the conversations that continue. The other thing is about types of families. So there's some great books, kids' books, about every family is different. And that just starts, that's a lifelong conversation and way of thinking about, you know, challenging the idea what family needs to look like, you know, and what relationships of care need to look like and all of those sorts of things.
So, in fact, we were talking about family planning before, the name family planning, but really the byline is for everybody in every family. So it's just...
Exactly. That's right. And getting kids to think about who is their family, what matters to them, how do these relationships work and so on. So the second era is kind of the one that I'm in at the moment, which is where kids are a bit older, heading into adolescence. And I think for me it's about now it's about clarifying misconceptions, and that's partly because they're getting information from elsewhere, from stories from friends, increasingly from online environments, YouTube videos, etc., but also things they've misunderstood from what we've talked about, and including books and so on. Like, it's just incredible how kids can misunderstand something that you're pretty sure wasn't that complicated, but no, they got completely the wrong idea. And also that includes things like that you kind of think that they will understand. So my children have two mums. Actually, they got three mums because they have a stepmum as well. And that in it's always amazed me that that hasn't necessarily mapped onto understanding that even ideas about conception and fertility and family structures and relationship structures are not just the heteronormative kind of norm. So even my children who know that in terms of their own world, world experience, need kind of to be to have that as an ongoing conversation mm-hmm. about what, you know, what are the ways in which we understand this in a broader way. And the, you know, the era I have not entered yet is really the kind of late teens, early adulthood. Mm. And but I'm very convinced by some colleagues that I have who I just think are wonderful, who work in the area of young people, digital media and sexuality. So Kath Albury, Paul Byron, Brady Robards, there's many others in Australia who are really world-leading researchers in this area. And they have just shown through their work time and time again that we have to trust that young people will have the capacities and the strengths that they need to know how to navigate digital sexual cultures and digital media and other ways in ways that will keep themselves and their partners safe, mm-hmm. even as they're dealing with a whole range of new complexities and challenges. So they're not shying away from the fact that image sharing and forms of online abuse and all kinds of coercive behaviours and so on is a part of their new normal. What they don't want us to do is assume that as adults we know better than the young people themselves around how to help how to resource them to know how to navigate that mm-hmm. successfully. So I take solace in the fact that I can keep reading that research to inspire me not to panic when my children are really getting into the age where it does get scary in thinking about wanting them to have good experiences, they feel good about themselves, and that they don't contribute to cultures which are problematic to me, but also are still based in good information and good, you know, ways of helping them understand how to make the choices they're going to make.
So that comes back to that idea of trust, doesn't it?
It
so
does,
it is that trusting that young people, in fact, to all young people, you're absolutely right, they can potentially they can navigate what's there before them, and we shouldn't feel so anxious about it. We should actually just, as you say, just actually support them and know that actually it's very different to, you know, to when we were there. Mm-hmm. But just feel, I mean, I suppose that's how I've done my parenting, is just to ensure that I'm always there if they need to talk about anything, but that you are actually trusting them.
Yeah.
But also you're there if they do feel that they're getting in trouble, if they do have a negative experience, that they can actually share that. They may not share it straight away, but they can share it, and that they've got someone trusted they can go to and talk to about it. So I think it's really important.
I'll just say one thing. So, you know, I think I've found it very helpful to know that all of the big research studies on the impacts of sexuality and relationships.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Education have shown positive outcomes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can as parents worry that if we talk frankly about concepts that feel adult to us, like sex of all kinds, but that includes sexual practices which may be considered to be slightly less normative. So same-sex sexual practices or queer kink, bi practices, non-monogamy, for example, that somehow that will mean we're going to influence those kids to live lives that might be different. And certainly there's a lot of fear around sexual debut, the idea of the age at which you begin to become sexually active, being somehow accelerated by access to information. And we just know that that is absolutely not true.
It's the data again.
Well,
I can say from personal experience, that's correct. Because I found porn when I was 8, 9, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. I didn't start masturbating until I was 13, 14. Mm-hmm. So well after that.
Yeah.
And then I didn't have my first sexual experience with another human being until I was, I don't know, 20. Mm, I mean, so I was a late bloomer, I guess you might say.
Yeah, and actually we know that the young people are having sex at a later age now, and
that's
they're
right.
often having fewer sexual partners. So,
yes, and there's good, there is good data.
Yeah.
Just around.
I'm not saying data's bad.
No. Just that delaying of sexual debut, and you're right, there is often a lot of concern about that, is it getting lower, and in fact it's not, it's staying the same. But in countries like Holland, if we come back there, then there is that delay in that sexual debut with good sex positive educational comprehensive sexuality education.
Yep.
So I think we but of course, you know, the tabloid press would not
of course not.
Right.
Look, not having sex does not sell papers.
Exactly. And we do know that, you know, that introducing kids to ideas about and I don't want to say non-normative because they're part of our world, but introducing them to ideas about relationship types or gender expressions or sexualities that may be different from the family of origin, that there are fears that will then somehow encourage kids to be thinking differently about their own life choices, but also that we still hear the argument that children raised in same-sex parented families or by transgender parents will themselves be more likely to be sexually or gender diverse in a variety of ways. And again, the research, which is pretty comprehensive now from a number of different settings, shows that that's just not the case.
It doesn't make sense.
No.
It's so funny. It does go back to that ignorance. It's clearly what's spouting that. Mm. And we spoke before we started recording, about the signs that they used to hold up at protests in the States, which was, if you don't want gays to get married, tell the straight people to stop having gay children. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the perfect example of... Mm.
Yeah, that's right.
That doesn't make sense. You know, and you look at like career choices.
Mm-hmm.
So let's think of a family where you've got a doctor and a lawyer. Like, you know, that doesn't mean that every child that they have is going to be either a doctor or a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have artists come out of there.
Absolutely.
So it's just that I think the knowledge is I'm a firm believer that knowledge is always power. The more you know, the better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now I will say there are some caveats to that. WebMD,
sure.
You know, you have to be careful.
You do.
Yeah.
What you do with that information.
Yes, yeah.
That information can often be used as a weapon for good or for evil, but you need to be careful, I guess, about how you wield it. But I think, again, you raise children with that understanding that this is information.
Mm.
Do with it as you will. But
this
you
also have to help them learn how to handle that information and how to navigate and what do you do with this. Because, like you said, just because you have information doesn't always mean it's a good thing, but if you kind of help your children to figure out how do you wade through all of this and how do we cull it to and shape it and use it to shape ourselves and in a way that's good and that's positive.
And some of that is about how you model that.
Yeah.
How do you show them that you're a person that can find information that you need as you need it, that doesn't that knows how to make choices carefully, that acts in ethical ways in the various relationships that they have, including with your own children, you know.
Yeah, although it is interesting, isn't it? Because some of the research does show that young people are able to navigate very well, and they're able to work out what's credible and what's junk.
That's true.
And actually work their way through. But
can they teach some of the older people, especially the voters?
But I think that modelling still is really important, you're right, because there is a tsunami of information. And you're right, just information per se is not going to do it, is it? Right. You need to be able to use it in an effective way. So I agree. But being able to know where to go is really important.
So I want to go back to something that you said a very long time ago about your children's friends coming and asking you questions and being available to ask to answer questions for them. So how do you handle that when you obviously have a good relationship with your children and you're able to talk to them about things, but they may not have that with their parents, so they're coming to you or to another resource, but you know, your children clearly have more information, and so they go to school or interact with these other children. How does that work as far as, do they come back to you and say, oh, well, so-and-so didn't know this, that, or the other? Or, like, is it more just that I can have these conversations with my mom, maybe if you have questions that maybe she can help? Or, like, how does that work when your children are a little bit more aware than maybe other children are?
Yes, I think it's probably a real mixture of all sorts of things. I mean, I think, you know, that there was knowledge that I work at family planning, and I think what that helped was then, you know, these other young people going on the internet, looking at the family planning website, that supporting them in actually being able to ask some questions, know that they could, you know, come and ask me questions as well. So I think it's a real mixture of all sorts of things. But I think it was a very positive thing for my daughters, actually, because it's sort of, you know, they had that bit of extra knowledge, as you say, and they were then able possibly they were giving some advice as well. I suspect. I hope it was all right. If it was right.
It is interesting, though. You do see a variety of knowledge in kids. Mm-hmm. And I can be a bit shocked sometimes if I realise that some kids will come out with something that you think, oh, my goodness, they've really got no idea. They've clearly had no conversations at home about this. And that's always a bit confronting because it's not your place as a parent.
Right.
And I have to be very careful around that, of course. If I think back to some examples, it's always just giving some general information about where you can go to find things out, or you can always go and visit the family planning. I mean, it would obviously be age-appropriate, but, obviously I also can't cross professional boundaries. So there's all sorts of things that I have to be aware of. But it is just, I think it was actually just that awareness of, oh, my daughter's, you know, mum works at family planning. What's that about? What does it do? It actually raised that awareness of actually there's more, it's more than just contraception. It's talking about safer sex. It's talking, there's all sorts of resources for young people they perhaps didn't know about before. So I think that was a really good thing.
Yeah. So that leads me to another question. I remember when I was in fifth or sixth grade, very young, that we were all convinced that the way to get a woman pregnant, we knew only women could get pregnant, that's surprising, but the way that she got pregnant was you peed in her belly button. So we were, that was science. We knew that. So how do you deal with when your kids come back with such horrible information? I guess, how do you make yourself a credible source? And then how do you fix the misinformation that they get from the world out there?
So that's where those resources, having those excellent resources. Now look at your bookshelf. Because I have many of these books as well. Yeah. So it's actually having those really great resources. Because you're right, as you as a parent, it's good to have backup. It's good to have backup.
And kids will often trust them more than they trust you, so which is fair enough. It's a good instinct to be, you know, a bit, think twice.
Yeah.
But it's if you get good resources and they keep getting updated, they're going to know more than even us working in this area. You know, they know how to pitch it in a way which is which is age appropriate because it's tricky to remember.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah, but it's great that, you know, you, in inverted commas, is coming and asking that. You know, that's a great start, isn't it? Because then you've got that start of that conversation, which is going to carry on, as you say, for a lifetime. And I know we talked about adolescence sort of, you know, letting go of adolescence, but obviously you've still got that ongoing relationship with your adult children. They'll possibly become parents themselves, possibly not, but you've got that ongoing discussion. So, and I do think, look, humour isn't appropriate everywhere, but I think having humour in things can be a very helpful approach sometimes as well. It has to be pitched appropriately. It depends what your communication or style is within your family. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, just being able to sometimes have a light touch is a good way to go. But again, you've got to work out what the circumstances are. If it's all around consent and inappropriate touching, and perhaps something has happened that the young person wants to talk to you about, then you've got to work out what's the best way to approach that.
It's interesting, again, reading articles. I actually do read a lot of parenting articles. I don't know why, but I find them fascinating because, you know, it's that younger generation that will someday being paid, will pay for my life.
They're the ones that are going to take care of us.
Yeah, exactly, because we have no children, so we're on society's child. But talking about consent and how I remember growing up, when you would leave a family's house, you had to give hugs and kisses to everybody. That was, you know, you had to do that. Yes. And I think about that now, those times that I didn't want to because I didn't feel like it or whatever. And you're seeing these articles now saying, you know, don't force your child. That's a consent problem. You know, your child you should not force your child to hug somebody that they don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I look back at that now, I'm like, wow, that is brilliant. Mm-hmm.
And the same things apply to things like eating.
Yep.
So we don't now say to kids, finish everything on your plate, because that's teaching them to ignore the feelings in their body. And what we want is to teach them how to trust those feelings. It's not always, you know, there'll be some not wanting to eat your greens, for example.
Right.
They may trust that deeply and they may need to push through that particular feeling. But you work with them. Mm-hmm. You don't say, we know better than you.
Right.
And you need to push through this in order to make us happy as a family culture. It's really been very gratifying to see that become much more popularly recognised, the idea that it's teaching children the absolute wrong thing to ask them to ignore their bodily desire to not have this intimate contact with a person that they often don't really know very well.
Yeah.
It really is the opposite of what we should be talking about in terms of consent and bodily integrity.
Well, exactly. And it's something that you're putting like that, again, that intimate contact before knowing the person.
Mm.
And that to me sets up a lot of pitfalls for later on down the line.
Absolutely.
You know, so if I'm forcing my child to hug and kiss somebody, like an aunt, even an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent that they see once a year, once every other year, you know, just...
They don't have that contact and intimacy with them.
So you're forcing that intimacy before the comfort.
We're teaching them that it's more important to be good and to fulfill a social role and to satisfy the external social expectations than it is to feel good and safe. And that is really very dangerous for all kids. You know, the focus has been very much on girls recently, post Me Too. But these are conversations and ideas that need to be taught to kids of any gender from as early as
possible. So are you reading this in your parenting magazine?
Look, all I'm saying is if something pops up on Facebook, Twitter, that is...
Yeah,
parenting, especially if it's consent related or gender related, I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
Even not having kids, I think it's so important to have this space where
you do know that not having kids doesn't mean that you don't contribute to the way that socially we are raising a new generation.
And that's my hope, honestly. You know, it's like because I want. My hope is that, you know, especially with us being non-monogamous, that the friends that we have who have kids who are non-monogamous, you know, they'll feel comfortable.
Yes.
A bisexual young man. If I'd had a beacon or a person that I could talk to when I was growing up, I know a lot of the turmoil, the inner turmoil and the shame and all the problems that I had with regards to sexuality, I could have avoided that if I just had somebody just to vent to, just to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so yes, very much. I hope that I can be, or we can be, depending on which, you know, what you're looking at. I don't think you're going to be a good model for my sexual.
The modeling is the really important part, isn't it? Because it is through modeling, it is showing your children how to be with close family, with aunts and uncles, with strangers, and just that modelling, I think, is a, you know, it's a vital part of parenting, but also it being exposed to different models of parents as well. I think
absolutely.
In order to know you're doing something right, you definitely have to see people who are doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's the same concept of you don't really appreciate a sunny day until it rains.
Yeah. And look, just to come back to that idea about what do you do when other kids who are not your children have incorrect information. Mm-hmm. Just one example, it also talks about modelling, is that, you know, my kids have, as I said, they're being raised in same-sex parented family, and that's not that common in their school. It's not completely uncommon in our area. It's actually, you know, not that noteworthy. And yet it was amazing to me how many kids were blown away by this idea, and they'd come running up to you at school and be like, how can your daughter have two mums? How is that possible? And you know, my role there is not to school that child in sexual and gender politics, but I can certainly confirm to them, yes, it's possible to have two mums. Some families have two mums, some have two dads, some have one, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you know, that's a way that we do as a community play a role in showing that there are different ways to do ethical relationships, family structures, ways of relating that are part of the fabric of our social life, not separate from the norm.
So did you find yourself educating other parents as well?
Well, I've had a few moments where I've thought, and certainly during marriage equality and the debates around marriage equality, that became a difficult experience we felt as a family that there was more attention on us, and that certainly we know from the outcome, a third of Australians didn't support marriage equality, and so that's a good reminder. And not far from my area, there were sort of no voting electorates, and that, you know, that's a reminder that that there are very different views. And again, you know, as I sort of said at the beginning, my attitude is not to come in with assuming that everybody needs to change their mind and agree that the way that we have parented is something that they support. But I also know that the children, if they ask the question about whether that's possible, I know that is a true fact. Yes, it is possible. Mm-hmm. I also know it's safe, healthy, and, you know, completely legitimate. And also we know that now at the national level also that's been accepted. So that's one example of a topic which can be very contentious in some families and very ordinary in others. Mm-hmm. And what we really need is to have just broader conversations generally with our kids.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
I think that's great advice as well. And I think it's, you know, it's funny. I didn't know how this podcast was going to go when we started recording it. But I think for me, what I'm gathering is that every child is different, which I think we all know inherently. As long as you keep the information age appropriate and also child appropriate, because you know, you get 100 children at the age 7, their comprehension, what their life experiences, what they're ready to accept, their lens is different, and you just have to make sure that you fine tune your story and your tale, their information, so that they can grasp it and do, I guess, process it. And clearly come back to you and ask you the same questions over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's right. And I will just say that the schools are essential in this process also. So, you know, even for me, I would consider myself a sex positive parent. I'm somebody who leads with kind of feeling very strong in the area of sexuality and relationships ideas, that's not something that makes me uncomfortable. And yet, even in my case, when my kids hit the age where they began to have those conversations in the classroom setting, that opened up a whole range of new conversations that had never happened for us. And really, they were coming to me with new questions in a way that I was really surprised by, actually. I was very grateful to the school for that. So that's even more important, maybe, for kids who come from families where there's no conversation. And we know there are families where you cannot talk about sex in any form. You can barely talk about bodies. And so I think we just have to recognise both that schools are just how essential they are. And also they're really managing a whole range of pressures in complicated ways because the families they support are so diverse. So I'm very grateful.
But they do an amazing job, I agree. But so again, just thinking as you're talking. So I certainly see young people where, in fact, they can't, for cultural reasons often, or they can't talk to their parent, but they do find someone. Maybe it is an older sister. Maybe it is an aunt, and they do find someone to be able to have those conversations with. So there can be other sort of figures. And I think, again, it just school obviously is exposing you to a whole young people to a whole different environment, but also thinking about going to, you know, other people's families. Sort of, I think it's so important to be exposed to different the way that people live in different ways. And I know I'm thinking back to, you know, when people... friends of my daughters would visit our place, and you know, just you're right, the way we eat our food is different, the way we you know, deal with television is different, all of those different things. But it's really this is the way we do things around here, and that that works. It works, so I think that exposure is really important. But I think, you know, there are different ways to find that information, so not forgetting about the, you know, the older siblings, etc.
And look, just to your point about being non-monogamous and thinking about the kind of and bisexual and thinking about the kind of the additional experiences that you bring, but also modelling that you can do for people in the community about those both being legitimate, ethical, totally appropriate, just part of the normal part of our social life. Yeah. What we don't have is enough research that will show how families can have conversations really around both of those. We have some around lesbian parenting, we have some around gay parenting, very little, much less on bisexuality, very little on polyamorous and non-monogamous families. We do have this 120-year study in the US by Elizabeth Sheff, which is incredibly valuable on the experiences of children who have grown up in polyamorous families, and really being able to look at how they've navigated those experiences, what they think of that now, what that's meant for their own lives. And I think that probably one of the main conclusions, which applies in my mind anyway, across these ideas around sex-positive parenting, is that those kids are, by and large, in great shape and no more likely to be polyamorous themselves than other communities, but they're more willing and able to talk about what it means to be non-monogamous, what the choices are about, like what, how people might decide to make, to decide that that's the right fit for them in their lives. And so again, what we see is that we don't have to be scared of the information. The information just leads to more conversations.
Knowledge is power.
Absolutely. It is.
So we're running short on time, and I'm opening up a can of worms here. I know this.
Go for it.
It's something I really wanted to say earlier, and I just forgot, and then whatever. I want both of your all's opinion on porn. Whether or not it has a place in the third stage of young adult, and then young adulthood, whatever. How do you talk to your children about porn? When do you talk to your children about porn? And overall, what's your general opinion? And go.
So I think it's really important to acknowledge its existence. I think that's they're going to find it anyway. So I think, you know, you need to actually have that conversation. But I think what I would say is there's porn and porn. So you want to be able to... Again, it's around being able to be discerning, isn't it? So you want to, again, it's around how do young people get the information, how do they use what's out there, and how can you teach them and model around being discerning and knowing what's a useful thing to see and what's a thing to reject. So I think, you know, we know that it's there. And so I, you know, from my perspective, I think we have to acknowledge it. Again, the research is there to show that it can be, you know, very positive for people, for young people as well. It has to be age appropriate. But that would be my take on it.
Yeah. I mean, again, my in terms of personal impact, my children are still young. However, we do know that kids' exposure to porn is much younger than what most people would be aware of. So my key approach has always been just that they understand what that means, that they also have a good understanding of the problems of digital devices and the sharing of images, including why we are
very, very careful and explain to them about why bodies are not, certainly not naked bodies, are never recorded in image form, and the risks of sharing. So I do introduce some of those ideas also because they're old enough to consent to any image of them being shared or not on social media, which is a conversation between myself and my kids, which is actually quite challenging for me because I quite like sharing images. But they get to decide that now, and that's really important for me to recognize and to value.
I think that's brilliant.
But I think so. You know, I think one of the things people worry about with porn and young people is that it's changing what sex involves for young people. And while I think that we have some areas in which we that's a really important question to ask, because it is a new social development in the history of human sexuality. We have not had imagery of this kind, you know, accompanying our brain development through adolescence and so on in a way that we do now. I still believe that may lead to some problems that we then can find ways to help with, rather than assuming that porn is a terrible thing and we need to close it all down. Like we don't have to pick between, you know, good sex and porn. I think we can. We actually no longer can.
Yeah.
I think porn is a part of our world in some way.
Yeah.
But the other thing, we've heard some real kind of media panics around young people believing that the acts they see in porn isn't what you do in ordinary sexual life, and it's changing the way that the expectations of young people in particular around how to do sex. And I like this analogy. I'll probably butcher it, but what I've been told is that young people know that porn is to real sex like a soap opera is to their real high school. So it's not the same thing. Yeah. Like, it's not as in, you
like
know,
Glee. It's like nobody lives in Glee.
Exactly. But it's staged as actors. It's all about the effects. It's and so on. So they can understand they need to learn things differently. Yes, in real life. Yeah. And what we need is to be still providing our young people with the information.
But that comes back to that importance of communication starting that very early age.
Very early.
Because you are supporting, as a parent or a trusted other, you're supporting that young person in having that understanding about what's real and what's not.
Yes.
And you know, that you also want that young person to have credibility in the world. They need to know, you can't lock someone away. They need to know what's going on in the world, but be able to use that information in a way that isn't damaging, but also just in that sort of conscious way which distinguishes, you know, what's harmful and what's not.
And because I'm an annoying parent, I will also want to talk to them about the political economy of porn. Who's getting paid for the images
for your
that
porn.
They see?
Yes. That's right.
What does ethical porn mean, and why might that matter?
Yeah.
We're similar parents.
But I think that's a part of the picture. Yeah. And also, that, as you said, there's porn and there's porn. So, you know, if I'm talking to them carefully about things to do with ethics and consent and violence, then is that going to factor into how they read the forms of porn that may come to them? Because the other thing is that kids like to shock each other.
Yeah.
And so preparing my kids to see things that they might not even seek out themselves, but may just arrive in their world, and for them to be able to make sense of that, we use a traffic light system in terms of internet use, which is that, you know, when they're looking at something on YouTube or whatever, if green is when they know that nobody in their life would have any trouble with them watching it. They could watch it with their grandparents. Orange is when they get a feeling like, I don't quite know what's going on here. I think it's okay. I could probably ask mum, but I'm just feeling slightly differently about it. It might be a bit secret. Red is when they know straight away, like, whoa, no, turn it off. And so we've talked about, as soon as that, it's up to you to know for your brain, shut it off. Because I can't always be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just think
it's an interesting way to look at it.
It's a consent-based approach to thinking about what's good for you, what feels right. And it's hard for me to trust that, but I'm not always going to be there.
Yeah,
no.
You can't.
No. And I'm coming back to the bodies bit of porn as well, because obviously that's the other concern is around, and we talked about it earlier, about that, am I normal? What's normal?
Yeah.
That's and true. That's how distorting. Again, it's about having those conversations to know what's real and what's not real.
Yeah.
And it's important that, again, if I just think around the people close to me, it's just important that there's an awareness of the conversation around porn and bodies, because they may well come across someone else who sort of who says, "Oh, that's not what what things are supposed to look like,"
yeah.
and that's you know, that can be a very shocking thing. And I certainly see young women who have really been very distressed after a maybe a throwaway in inverted commas line. And knowledge is power, so to know that this
absolutely.
Image has come from something that's completely not real is so important.
And,
so,
and that's where the kind of counter images that we see developing in terms of the labia library, which is Victoria, and also the kind of movements around young women and body hair, for example, that you see on social media, are kind of pushing back against compulsory body hair removal. But we know that there are increasing rates of labiaplasty that are happening among young, among women, and we know, like, so there are things that body positivity is actually central to sex positive approaches to parenting, in my view. Those two things are totally wrapped up in each other.
We often use the porn analogy that equating porn to real sex is sort of like saying you've seen the movie Jaws and suddenly you're a marine biologist, or you've watched Star Wars, so you're an astronomer. That's so few people understand, we've interviewed both porn producers and actresses, and how much is storyboarding. Like, porn, most porn is storyboarded. Bodies are prepared for sometimes 2 to 3 days in advance before an anal sex scene. There's a lot of effort that goes into it to make it look easy, natural, and not staged, when in fact it's not easy. It sometimes feels unnatural. And it is totally staged. Angela herself, we've done photo shoots where she's in, the photographer will say, okay, this is going to feel really unnatural, but I need you to twist and this and that, and now exhale on the count of three, go.
Yeah.
And then, click, 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 and you see the pictures, and it looks like she's just lightly lounging across a sofa. And you're like, that's amazing. But knowing what goes into it, I think makes it, it's important to know that things are...
And I think that kids get that when you talk to them about it, because they're taught much more about critical analysis of media generally now. They're taught more about how production, how things are produced. Maybe not all schools, but
I'm thinking of it as life's literacy. So we talk about health literacy. It's part of life's literacy that you actually need to have that understanding that there is porn out there and how it's made. So it is part of that. And so we need to ensure, locking people is like the abstinence-only sort of argument, sort of, shutting away any information is, that's not going to...
It's doing a disservice.
Doing a disservice.
And there's no way, you can't put the genie back in the bottle.
So we've mentioned a number of resources throughout this podcast. We will put links to them all in the show notes. Another one that I wanted to bring up as well, and this would be more for once you do start kind of the I would say more the adolescent, perhaps, depending on your child, talks about sex and sexuality. It's a book called Drawn to Sex, The Basics by Erica Mullen.
And Matthew Nolan. I guess Matthew Nolan, I think, is part of that. I know Matthew is part of the Ojoy sex toy.
Yeah.
Oh, I've heard the about series. This one. I haven't seen it, but I've heard it.
Drawn to Sex is amazing.
Yeah, so Ojoy sex toy is a series of four books, and they're graphic novels, but they're basically where they talk about small little sections where they talk about different sex toys and lubes and the positives and negatives and what you might use it for, that type of thing. They also talk about venues, performances, burlesque, and that kind of thing as well. So I think that's definitely a little more
also
older.
Also contraceptive.
Right. But then the Drawn to Sex, The Basics, it's very body positive, very inclusive.
Very consent.
And very consent based. And it does talk about what sex looks like, what gender looks like, what STIs are. It talks about contraception.
Right.
So there's a lot of different things in there. And I think that's, you can start at a younger age. But again, check it out if you're interested, and depending on the age of your children.
Always read things first before you become up.
It's
common sense.
Yeah. But I think those are both very good. And they're done in a graphic novel style, so they're easy for everybody to understand.
Family Planning New South Wales as well. We've got something called Body Talk, which is an interactive online resource for all around bodies.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And so it's great, and it's trying to think of the age range, actually. So it's age appropriate, and it's worth checking out that on the, okay, on the website too.
Awesome. So we'll link to that as well.
Yep. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And then also, lastly, the book that you saw. Oh, so there was Max Black.
Yeah. So there was a book that I saw at Max Black. Admittedly, didn't open it, didn't read it, don't know anything about it, but it drew my interest. It's called Sexuality and Relationship Education for Children and Adolescents with Autism Spectrum Disorders. Yeah. It's by Davita Hartman, and it drew my attention because we do have some friends who have children on the autism spectrum, and I sent a picture to them and was like, hey, just so you know, this is out there if you're interested in looking at resources, and because their children are getting to that age, and she was immediately like, oh my gosh, where is that, you know, can I get, and so I think it is good to kind of, if you do have children with special needs, to look for resources geared towards that as
Absolutely. There's another one, Making Sense of Sex by Sarah Atwood, which is also for kids on the spectrum.
Okay.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And okay. Again, at Family Planning, we've got resources for parents with children with cognitive impairment, for instance, and just all around development. There's lots of things to look at around disability as well. So
excellent. That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, there you go. That's just proof that you have no excuse not to talk to your kids. Like, somebody's going to talk to your kids. It should probably be you.
Yeah.
Don't pass it off onto somebody else. Don't give that responsibility to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You want to control what your kids...
Don't be scared.
Yeah. And if it's something that you're learning along with your kids, that's even better. I think that kids...
That's okay too.
Yeah, kids respect the fact that you don't necessarily have all the answers, and like you said, Kristen,
I learn from my kids every day, right? Mm-hmm. And they're teaching me about the world that they will inhabit.
Yeah. Parenting is a team-based sport, and the kids are part of that team. So very much encourage people. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, rude remarks, you know we love them, reach out to us. We can put you in contact with Dr. Deb and Christy. Yeah, send us a message, and
yeah,
definitely appreciate it.
And thank you guys so much for coming
on
and for being part of this for a long extended session.
Yeah.
So much good information, and we really, really do appreciate it.
It's good stuff.
Thanks for all the work that you do also.
Now I'm blushing. All right.
Hi, this is Jace, co-host of the Multi-Amory podcast. We offer new ideas and advice for multiple forms of love, everything from conscious monogamy to ethical polyamory and radical relationship anarchy, and you're listening to a Swing Set Network podcast. Find us and much more at swingset.fm.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.